Okay, so as David told you, after some really good talks by the participants in the two programs, I've been nominated to tell you about what some of the locals are doing, and indeed many of the locals are working on string theory. That includes me, David, Per Berglund, Amanda Peet, Aki Hashimoto here at the ITP, and then in the department, Gary Horowitz, Steve Giddings, Roberto Emperon, Philippe Pouliot, and a number of students. So they're scattered around the audience in various places. Let me start with a timeline. Something like this. I guess we need 1970 over here, and 1980, 1990, and here's today. And let me graph the level of activity in string theory as measured by the number of people or the number of papers or the average adrenaline level of someone working in the field. It's a peak like that, and then probably have to get that little dip even lower, and then whoa, and then some kind of exponential decay with maybe a 2 or 3 year time constant. Maybe a bit. And then whoa, and then maybe it's decaying again just a little bit. Okay, oops, I didn't quite that bring that up to today. Oh, well, you get the idea. Sorry? Well, you can argue about the relative heights and widths and everything of the peaks and the valleys. This is schematic, and everybody will have their own different impression of, again, this is more the adrenaline level than anything else. And everybody will have their own impression of, yeah, certainly I guess the integrated number of papers must be much larger in here. Anyway, but let me start with this and label each of these peaks and valleys. So this first period here was the period when people were thinking about string theory as a theory of the strong interaction. A meson was supposed to look like that, a string with endpoints, and the endpoints in today's language would be quarks and antiquarks. And that was very nice, but that whole subject ended very abruptly around 1973 with the discovery that the correct theory of the strong interaction was something else. A gauge theory, QCD. Now, although I've drawn this as peaks and valleys, in fact, the actual level, the actual rate of scientific progress doesn't necessarily track the adrenaline level in the field. It's sort of like the light not tracking the mass. There's various biases. And in fact, during this seemingly quiet here, when really a very, very small number of people were working in the field, enormous discoveries were made. In fact, during this period, well, what happened was those who had worked in the field in this time, many of them felt that even though they had the wrong theory of the strong interaction, they discovered something very beautiful that should be good for something. And in fact, it was understood during this period that string theory is not a theory of the strong interaction, it's a theory of gravity. And even better, it's a theory which seems to be finite order by order in perturbation theory. So it's a perturbatively finite theory of quantum gravity. Now, that's good, but what really set things off here was a series of discoveries, one on top of the other, which showed that not only is string theory a theory of quantum gravity, but it seems to fit very well with not just gravity, but everything, all the particles in the standard model. It dovetails very nicely with previous pre-string theory unifying ideas for understanding the patterns in the standard model and trying to unify them. Things like grand unification, supersymmetry, Kaluza-Klein theory. Okay. And this period, which again must be a much, I think it really must be a much higher peak considering the number of papers.
Can you say a couple more words about the KK?
Not now, but let me, as we go along, I'll talk about later at an appropriate point what it means to have dimensions beyond four. And that's what that is. Okay. That's what that means. That means dimensions, there are more than four. That refers to the specific thing, but in a general sense, the idea that there are more than four dimensions. And I will get back to that. Okay, and in this intervening period, well, there were various peaks, some of them. Anyway, but what really, again, started a whole new wave of interest in this subject is a number of new discoveries. Let's see, these include the strong, weak duality in string theory, the unity of all string theories. I'll explain these later on. The discovery of a whole new dimension, not the fifth, but the 11th. Let's see. Discovery of some new excitations in string theory, the D-brains, and also a new understanding of black hole quantum mechanics. Now, there's not a lot of, well, if your standard is that the goal here is to try to make real quantitative contact between string theory and particle physics, then these discoveries here seem not to be going in that direction, but in some other direction. However, as I'll try to convey, understanding these things is undoubtedly a necessary step towards one of the long-term goals, which is, in fact, to make these broad patterns that I mentioned here to turn that into something much more precise. Okay, so with that outline, let me go back and start again here and talk a little bit about what it means to have a perturbatively finite theory of quantum gravity, and then go on. So if you take general relativity and the standard model and treat them like any other quantum field theory, any other field theory, quantize them in the natural way, well, you get Feynman diagrams, you get amplitudes, and so the squiggly line here is supposed to be a graviton. You get things like this. Any process, whatever you're looking at, is a sum over all, coherent sum over all ways it can occur, and also all points in space and time where these interactions can occur. And from simple dimensional analysis, one finds that this first correction to the leading amplitude diverges. It diverges in the limit when all of these interactions are taking place at the same point in space and time. So in the limit that these approach one another in their actual space-time position, that amplitude diverges. Now, as to what that means, well, there's at least one very similar thing in the history of particle physics, which is the weak interaction, which initially was thought of as some kind of local interaction involving four fermions, say two ingoing and two outgoing. But again, by exactly the same dimensional argument, if you try to carry this to higher order, at the next order, you get infinity from when these two points approach one another. And as you go to higher orders, even worse infinities. Now, when you encounter a divergence like that, there are sort of two broad classes of interpretation. One is that it's not a real divergence in the theory, that it's an artifact of somehow this perturbation expansion that we're making. And if we were able to really sum up the whole series, everything would be finite. That's sort of, in the language of the renormalization group, that's a non-trivial ultraviolet fixed point. The other possibility, though, is that the theory that you're dealing with is incomplete, that it's good at long distance, but it's simply incorrect to extrapolate it down to this distance where the interactions become coincident and the divergence occurs. And, in fact, that's what's true in the case of the weak interaction. This local and space-time interaction, in fact, is resolved, when you look at it more closely, into the exchange of some virtual particle, a W or Z boson, and now everything is good. Now, in the case of quantum gravity, again, there are these two choices. There are various philosophical reasons for not liking the idea of an ultraviolet fixed point, and for concentrating on the possibility that what's happening is your theory is incomplete. There is some kind of physics at shorter distance that actually smears out these local interactions. Now, that's not easy to do. It's not just a matter of taking your Hamiltonian and putting some kind of smoothing function in it. Because, well, we have to respect what Lorentz invariance, unitarity, causality, and in particular, if you think about smearing in space, and remember that you have Lorentz invariance, you've got to smear in time as well. And once you start smearing out the interaction in time, causality seems like it's going to be a problem. It's not easy, in fact, to find a way to spread out the interaction in space-time and remove the divergences from the theory. In the case of the weak interaction, this is just about the only way that it can be done. That is exchange of a vector boson, and not just any old vector boson, but a vector boson associated with a spontaneously broken Yang-Mills theory, the Weinberg, in other words, the Weinberg-Salam theory or some other gauge theory. That's the only solution we know, and that's the one. Similarly, up here, we know of only one way so far to smear out these interactions in a consistent way, and it's a much more radical step than just introducing some new fields. It requires imagining that at very short distances, these particles participating in this interaction are not points, but are tiny strings, little loops, say. They could also have endpoints, but let me draw them with loops as closed loops for now. And as they propagate forward in time, they trace out some kind of world sheet, which is some kind of fattened version of that graph. I'm going to write one more term over here, so let me draw this over here. So some kind of fattened version of that Feynman graph. Okay, so the point particles have become little loops of string. They now have, of course, internal dynamics. So they can have various levels of internal excitation, which from the space-time point of view would be particles of different masses. But indeed, one of the discoveries here, right around when the idea of strings of strong interactions was ending, was that there was always a massless spin 2 particle in the theory. Not only could you not get rid of it, but you wanted it in there because it had all the right properties to be a graviton. Okay. Yeah. Let me save that. I mean, it's one of the other annoyances, again, during this period, was that the theory always seemed to need to live in 26 or 10 dimensions. And, in fact, the theories that are really consistent, that don't have tachyons, the dimension is 10. So this is a loop in the 10-dimensional space, but let me again save questions about dimensions beyond 4 until the appropriate time. Okay. This is the only way we know to smear out the gravitational interaction and make a finite theory. It's of course possible that there's lots of other things that also work, and we haven't been clever enough to find them yet. But at least in the case of the weak interaction, history shows that we were pretty clever because we were able to find only one solution. We collectively were able to find only one solution to the problem, and it was the one that nature chose. So here, having found even one solution to the problem, we should take it very seriously and see where it leads. And indeed, these points were being made by this small group of physicists during this period of time, who gradually caught the ear of a larger number of physicists. And then at this point, again, a series of discoveries which showed that not only is string theory a perturbatively finite theory of gravity, but it looks very much like a unified version of the standard model. That is, this string has many internal states of excitation. Depending on the internal state of excitation, it looks like different kinds of particles. And in fact, in certain string theories, there are states which look not only like gravitons, but like gauge bosons and like fermions. And in the simplest string theories, the gauge groups and the matter representations, the charges carried by the matter, hit exactly on the gauge groups and the matter representations that one needs in grand unified theories. So you take it very seriously just because it's a perturbatively finite theory of quantum gravity, and then it does all of these other things for you. In addition, having worked on many previous unifying ideas in field theory, there are always lots of free parameters, gauge couplings, other couplings, masses. In string theory, there are no free parameters, so it does for you what you would hope a unified theory does, which is to, in principle, predict everything. Okay.
Don't you want to write another term?
Oh, we're here?
Yeah.
I'm going to write one in a second. I want to write another one. Just to emphasize that this series is not as simple as adding of ladders. So, if, for example, the next term of the series might be something like this. You know, it's a complicated series, and I'll get back to that. Okay. So what's the problem? What's the problem if it fits with the broad patterns in grand unified theories? What do we need? The main practical problem is that although this theory has no free parameters, it has many, many ground states, and the actual physics that one sees depends on which ground state one is in. So the parameters in the theory have been transmuted instead into parameters in the ground state. Now, not all these states are stable, but the dynamics that makes only a small number of them stable is complicated and non-perturbative, and therefore not completely understood. And in fact, that's the main problem, is to understand the dynamics of string theory better. Because, as I've drawn quantum gravity here, or any field theory, it's a sum of Feynman diagrams. But the sum of Feynman diagrams doesn't capture all of the physics. Roughly speaking, when you're talking about Feynman diagrams, you're talking about small numbers of particles interacting weakly. And there was a time in field theory with quantum electrodynamics that was all one needed to see all of the physics. But when you get large numbers of degrees of freedom, and also possibly strong interactions, then there are many new qualitatively new behaviors that can occur that you don't see in this series. Things like spontaneous symmetry breaking, confinement, renormalization group flow, all have to do with having large numbers of degrees of freedom. And all of those properties of quantum field theories, of systems of many degrees of freedom, play an important role in the physics of the standard model, in the physics of the weak interaction and the strong interaction. So they had to be understood before the weak interaction and the strong interaction could be understood as gauge theories. Similarly, in string theory, well, string theory at long distance looks like field theory. Far enough away, that looks like that. A loop looks like a point. So string theory contains field theory. It has in it all of the same complicated dynamical things that field theory does. But in addition, since it has seemingly many, many more degrees of freedom, at least by some ways of counting, you would expect it to have interesting dynamics of its own. And we don't, or at least we didn't until recently, know anything at all about stringy dynamics. So just at a practical level, to go from here to real predictions, you have to understand the ground state energy, and that really requires a pretty detailed understanding of the dynamics. There's also a practical problem, which is that this sum doesn't even define the theory. It doesn't converge. It's at best asymptotic in some limited sense. There's a criterion for that Wilson, I think, set out for knowing that you really understand a theory, which is that if you had a large enough computer, you could, in principle, solve it. Now, if this is all you have, you can't do this, because you can calculate as many terms as you like. But again, no matter how many terms you have, this isn't a convergent series. It doesn't define the theory. In the case of quantum field theory, the answer was the path integral and the normalization group. And now we know that, and we actually do, people actually do, of course, solve it numerically. But also, we have a whole bunch of analytic methods for understanding the strongly coupled theory. In the case of string theory, again, this is all we have, so we don't have a definition of the theory. We don't understand the theory by Wilson's criterion. So, that's not just an artificial criterion, because generally, as in the case of field theory and the normalization group, the effort that it takes to understand what the theory really is, its definition, also tells you quite a bit about what its dynamics is. Okay. So, what has happened in the past few years is that we've, primarily by means of supersymmetry, understood a great deal more about the dynamics of string theory, and also, by the way, about the dynamics of quantum field theory. And again, these are some of the things we've learned. Let me start with this idea of duality. So this is, again, a series. There's a coupling constant here called little g, which we can make dimensionless by using the right units. So this is a series, and when the coupling is small, the terms get small fast, and it's roughly speaking an asymptotic series. When the coupling is large, as I've tried to emphasize, it's pretty useless. There are a few field theories which have the property of duality, which means that just in the limit, when things seem to be getting as bad as they might, there's a different theory, a dual theory, whose coupling is, roughly speaking, the reciprocal of that, which becomes weakly coupled. This is a very common phenomenon in 1+1 dimensional field theories like the Ising model. There have been conjectures for some time, but it was something that seemed unlikely to be true beyond 1+1 dimensions because beyond 1+1 dimensions, field theory gets much richer. You wouldn't expect such simple things to happen, but in fact, we now know that they do. And in string theory, which has many, many more degrees of freedom and is even more complicated, you'd, I think, be even more surprised if this held, or would have been even more surprised if such properties existed. But in fact, we now are pretty confident that also in string theory, something nice happens just when the coupling gets very, very strong and your perturbation theory is as useless as it could be. There's a different dual description which accurately describes the physics. This term duality comes up all over the place. It seems overused, but it's not really overused. It has a fairly precise definition. It simply means that you have two different systems, two different physical systems, which secretly turn out to be the same system when you correctly map the variables of one onto the variables of the other. And the reason the term is overused is because that's actually a very common phenomenon, which is good. In some sense, it means the whole problem is overdetermined because you can start from many different directions and you get to what turns out to be the same theory. Okay. As an example of this term being overused, there is another kind of duality, electromagnetic duality, which you first encounter the first time you see Maxwell's equations and notice that the electric field and the magnetic field appear in more or less the same way. The only difference being that the electric field has a source on the right side of the equation and the magnetic field doesn't. Of course, the question of magnetic sources, magnetic monopoles, is an interesting one. Dirac, of course, discovered interesting things about it. And then Atuft and Polyakov showed that, in fact, if you try to unify the electromagnetic interaction with the strong and weak interactions, you pretty much inevitably find that the unified theory has in it not only the electric states that you're used to, but also has in it particles that carry magnetic charge. You can't avoid them. They look rather different. The electrically charged particles in quantum field theory are points. They're small, they're light, they're weakly coupled. The magnetic monopoles are smooth field configurations, topologically non-trivial field configurations, so big and fuzzy. They're big and fuzzy, they're heavy, and they're strongly coupled. The Dirac quantization condition tells you that the force between electric charges is more or less reciprocal to the force between magnetic charges. So if this is weak, this is strong. There was a conjecture that in some field theories, in particular supersymmetric field theories, if you started with a weakly coupled theory and cranked up the coupling and followed it to very strong coupling, in fact, the entire picture would reverse. The electric charges would become large, heavy, strongly coupled. So this is G small. This is G large. And similarly, that's not surprising. If the coupling is strong, sure, things are going to get complicated. But also that as you turn up the coupling, the magnetic charges are going to become small, light, and weakly coupled. And so that, in fact, just when the electric coupling is very, very strong, there is a dual description of the same theory in terms of magnetically charged fields, which describes the same physics. So in fact, this electromagnetic duality is just one example of that general phenomenon of weak-strong duality. general phenomenon of weak strong duality. There were conjectures like this going back, not related to string theory, but to gauge theory, which I guess go back to about there. The evidence for them was circumstantial, and the general reaction was skepticism, until just recently, in 1994, Seiberg in particular started to systematically apply the constraints of supersymmetry to determinodynamics and supersymmetric theories, and very quickly he accumulated a great deal of evidence for interesting dynamical behavior, including, among other things, just this duality. And that was in gauge theory, and that was his first little blip here, and then applying those same methods to string theory led to similar kinds of understandings. And then there were deep brains and black holes and, well, that's today. Okay. So to say a bit about, let's see, let me tell you where I'm going. I want to say a very small amount about how this is done, about how supersymmetry is used, because there's sort of one little calculation we can do that hopefully makes the point a bit clearer, and then from there go on to these. So I'm going to write down some commutators in quantum mechanics for three kinds of operators, the Hamiltonian, some general conserved charge G, like, you know, just electric charge, or I'll say electric charge, and then Q, a supersymmetry. And Q, a supersymmetry, the defining property of supersymmetry is that Q turns fermionic states into bosonic states. So it gives you relations between the masses and the couplings of fermions and the masses and couplings of bosons, whereas ordinary symmetries just relate bosons to bosons and fermions to fermions. Now, saying we have a symmetry means that the Hamiltonian commutes with the charge, or in the case of supersymmetry, it commutes with the supercharge. But in the supersymmetry algebra, there is a second relation, which says that if you act twice with the supercharge, you get the Hamiltonian back. So that in some sense, the supercharge is the square root of the Hamiltonian. And actually, in general, you get another term on the right-hand side. You also get, well, you also get some ordinary charges appearing on the right-hand side of that relation. And roughly speaking, it's this second relation, which means that supersymmetry tells you much more about the dynamics than ordinary symmetries do. And again, this was understood in a sporadic way for a long time, but the real systematic application of this idea only began a few years ago.
This is so mysterious that this symmetry thing is going to tell us how to evolve things or something.
Within limits.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me give you one example of it, right? Because normally we're used to the idea of the dynamics and their symmetry. Symmetry relates some things to other things and tells you that some things are zero, whereas dynamics tells you their actual values. For example, for energy eigenvalues, symmetry tells you that some will be equal to each other, but dynamics, solving a Schrodinger equation, is required to find the actual value. In the case of the supersymmetry algebra, this second relation here enables you just from symmetry to know what the eigenvalues of what the masses, the energy eigenvalues of some states are. And to see that, let me first take an expectation value of this in some general state psi. So I'm just going to stick that between a couple psi's. And I forgot to mention, but this equation is supposed to have lots of indices on it to distinguish different. There are different supersymmetry generators, different components of the supersymmetry charge. And also, the units aren't right. There must be some constants in here, but that doesn't matter. Okay, so we take the expectation value of that. Now, in any theory that has a symmetry, there are going to be some states that are invariant under the symmetry, some states that are annihilated by the charge. And so it is in a supersymmetric theory. In general, there are states which are annihilated by some of the supercharges. Again, here I haven't written the index, but some of the Qs annihilate psi. A state which has that property, a state which is annihilated by some of the Qs, is called the VPS state, you could call it a supersymmetric state, because it's partly that just means that it's invariant under part of the supersymmetry. Now let's take this second relation here and consider what happens if psi is a VPS state. Well, on the left-hand side here, we get zero, because Q kills psi, it's Hermitian, it acts in both directions, Q kills psi. So for a VPS state, this second commutation relation tells us that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, which is the energy, is equal to or proportional to, since I left the constants out, is proportional to the expectation value of this ordinary symmetry generator, which is the charge. So this is an example of this phenomenon. You get dynamical information out, namely an energy eigenvalue just from symmetry, just from knowing that you have supersymmetry, that this is an invariant state, and knowing what its charge is. Okay, now this is, in terms of all of the dynamical information in the theory, a small amount. But in fact, it's enough when combined with everything else one knows. And in fact, one of the things that Seiberg did that was so clever was to really systematically employ the effective field theory point of view, the Wilsonian point of view, in combination with this symmetry. It was really the systematic application of those two ideas together that I guess we were all too busy doing other things, else it might have been done sooner. But okay, so this gives you dynamical information, and since everything in here just comes from symmetry, it doesn't depend at all on having a perturbation series. It doesn't depend on the couplings being weak. This is equally true at weak coupling as at strong coupling. The constants that appear in this relation depend on the coupling, and in fact, they depend in a way that, well, if you have enough supersymmetry, is determined completely by the symmetries. So you can use this kind of thing and other more clever applications of supersymmetry to map out a great deal of the strongly coupled dynamics. And by combining that information, again, with other things like the Wilsonian point of view, you can learn a great deal. When you apply this to string theory, you learn many things. And again, one of them, let me start with this, since it's been asked a number of times, is that there's an 11th dimension. Now, what does that mean? One way to think about this is in the language of broken symmetry. We're used to the idea that most of the symmetry that one has in the underlying Hamiltonian isn't actually realized in nature, in whatever system one is looking at. Symmetries are broken more often than not. Now, in particular, we see around us four more or less flat dimensions. So there's an SO31 Lorentz invariance, a four-dimensional Lorentz invariance. But since we're used to the idea of symmetry being broken, it seems natural to consider the possibility that the actual Lorentz invariance of the theory of the interactions is much larger. And in fact, in string theory, the Lorentz invariance of the interactions is SO91. It's the Lorentz invariance of 10-dimensional flat spacetime. What has been discovered is that if you take, well, there are several string theories. You take one of the string theories, I'll distinguish among them shortly. If you take one of the string theories, you look at its supersymmetric states at weak coupling, you follow them to strong coupling, and what happens at strong coupling is that many of them become light. You have many, many more light states at strong coupling than you did at weak coupling. In fact, you have enough light states to fill out an entire 10 plus 1 dimensional rather than 9 plus 1 dimensional phase space. So the strongly coupled limit of one of these theories, in fact, turns out to have a larger space-time, an 11-dimensional space-time, and a larger symmetry, SO101. So here's one of the first and neatest things that we've learned, that string theory has a lot more symmetry than is visible in the perturbation theory. This is all that's visible in the perturbation theory, but this at least is the actual symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and it was uncovered, again, by this rather roundabout argument of understanding a piece of the spectrum, following that to strong coupling, and then you have to work, you have to look at the spectrum and say, what kind of physics? Because in a spectrum like this, well, it's an 11th dimension. Okay, so from the point of view of symmetry breaking, it's natural to imagine that the Hamiltonian has a larger symmetry than four-dimensional Lorentz invariants. Of course, what symmetry breaking means in this context is that the space-time we live in isn't big and flat. Four of the dimensions are big and flat, and six, or it turns out seven, are very small and tightly curled up. This is the Kaluza-Klein idea, and again, it was around for a very long time, longer than almost anything else that appears on the blackboard, because it's actually it's an attractive idea for unifying the gauge interactions in gravity, and also an attractive idea for understanding why there are generations, why in the standard model there's a repetition of the same pattern of fermion quantum numbers. Okay, so found a whole new dimension, a larger symmetry. Okay, the strong weak, again, it's you start with any string theory, you understand it initially only in terms of its perturbation theories, but it has some supersymmetric states, some BPS states, you follow the strong coupling, and you say, hey, these are actually the states I would have if the strongly coupled theory were really some other weakly coupled theory, some other string theory. And one of the things, there have been conjectures, again, going back some time about this, but after the work of Seiberg, then Hall, Townsend, and Witten, in a very systematic way, looked at this, and for each string theory, there is a single natural candidate for the dual theory that describes its strongly coupled physics. In one case, again, it's this 11-dimensional theory, which is given the provisional name M theory. And M has been suggested to stand for membrane, matrix, mother, mystery. It's what you call a theory when you don't know what it is. You give it a deliberately ambiguous name. We know a lot about its symmetry because this number 11 is also a very special number from the point of view of supersymmetry. It's the largest Lorentz symmetry that's allowed in a theory that is supersymmetric. So in fact, there's a string theory didn't sort of make use of all of the symmetry supersymmetry could possibly have. But that's because perturbative string theory doesn't see the full symmetry of the world. Okay. Now, there used to be, it seemed, five different string theories which differ by whether the strings are closed or open, and which differ in detail by the nature of the space the strings vibrate in. Because in a supersymmetric theory, roughly speaking, the string vibrates not only in ordinary dimensions, but in some, well, mathematical fermionic dimensions. Those fermionic dimensions aren't being counted among the 11 because they're not real dimensions. They're infinitely thin. They're mathematical artifacts, but it's a useful way to think. Okay, so there were five different string theories that differed by sort of the kind of supersymmetry they had and what kind of strings you included. But now you take any of these five theories. These go by the name of 2A and 2B and type 1, and there are two heterotic strings. And you follow in the strong coupling. And I'm actually going to draw a two-dimensional, not a one-dimensional parameter space. Because I'm including here not just the coupling, but other parameters like the shape or size of some of these compactified hidden dimensions. So you start to follow the space of vacua, the space of classical solutions of the theory, as labeled by, again, the shapes of these dimensions and the coupling. And what you find is that starting from any of these, you can get to all of the others. There's only one theory. Yeah. I think there was always a feeling there should only be one string theory. In fact, I had a title for a paper. The title was There Is Only One String Theory, but I never had the body of the paper. And I didn't, of course, discover this, so I didn't get to use that title. But in fact, there is only one string theory. There's only one theory. The name M theory was first. Okay, there's actually, again, one more limit where the theory becomes 11-dimensional. And the name M theory was first given to this limit, but now M theory has come to mean sort of this entire space of theories, whatever it might be. The other things on my list here, strong, weak, unity of all strings, 11 dimensions, D-brains. A some time ago it was argued that string theories, or at least certain string theories, have in them not just these kind of things. And also, by the way, since the long distance physics of string theory is described by field theory, it also has in it field theoretic things like big fuzzy magnetic monopoles. But also that these string theories had to have a certain kind of topological defect, like a domain wall there, but with the property that strings can end on it. See, it's a domain wall, and this kind of string, which normally moves around as a closed loop, can hit this defect and break open, and its endpoints stick to the defect. The defect can be two-dimensional or one-dimensional or even zero-dimensional, and since there's more than four dimensions around, it can be higher dimensional as well. And these defects are what are called D-brains. D is for Dirichlet, brain is for membrane. Dirichlet just refers to the boundary condition that the endpoint is stuck. And these are useful because, in fact, they enable you to map out very much more of the weakly coupled physics, which then through this supersymmetric machinery, you follow the strong coupling. In particular, things that over here look like strings, you follow them over here. I guess over here they look like strings. You follow them over here. They turn out in this theory, when you follow the states in this way, to be D-brains. Maybe you follow them over somewhere else, and they turn out to be big fuzzy classical configurations. But you need all of these things, the strings, the D-brains, and the big fuzzy classical lumps of field to fill out the multiplets of this duality. Okay, this also, you would hope that any theory of quantum gravity would address not just the particle physics type problem of the ultraviolet infinities, but some of the more, relativistic type questions like initial conditions, or the problem of time, or the quantum mechanics of black holes. And in fact, as Gary Horowitz will tell you tomorrow in a department colloquium, and Amanda will tell you, I think, next Monday in a Blackboard lunch, string theory has begun to do just that, and I won't say anything more about that. Okay, so to conclude, where are we and what are we doing? Well, there's always been a suspicion that string theory wasn't really string theory, that little loops and strings, the things we always talk about, were not really the right degrees of freedom to think about, especially when the system becomes strongly coupled. But, it was just a suspicion. However, this recent progress makes that suspicion much better founded because, in fact, there's very little relation between the strings one sees in one limit and the strings one sees in another limit. Again, what looks like a string in one limit becomes a D-brain or a big fuzzy field configuration in another limit. And in fact, the different descriptions of these objects seem to have only a very limited range of validity, only in some limit where the theory looks like a weakly coupled string theory, is this valid? And none of these descriptions seem to have any range of validity larger than their natural one. It seems likely that to really map out this entire theory to satisfy Wilson's criterion of being able to tell a computer what it's supposed to compute, the right degrees of freedom to describe the theory are something else. And that's the next problem. And there are many guesses. I'll just mention the one guess which has attracted the most attention by far is that of all of the things I mentioned on the blackboard, it's these topological defects, the D-brains, and in particular the point-like ones, the zero-brains, that are actually the right degrees of freedom in the theory. This conjecture is known as matrix theory. It seems like a step backwards because this is back to point particles. Actually, it's two steps backwards because these are non-relativistic point particles. And the reason that it can possibly be right has to do with the fact that it's a Hamiltonian that had been written down many years ago, but how one interprets the amplitudes in that theory and maps them to amplitudes in space-time is somewhat subtle. Anyway, my own greatest interest right now, greatest focus right now, and for many of the people here, is to test this conjecture, because it's a very audacious conjecture. The statement is H, the Hamiltonian of everything, equals. And Banks, Fischler, and Susskind have proposed a right-hand side to that. The things that appear in the right-hand side are the positions and other degrees of freedom of these D0 brains. And the conjecture has been sitting out there for at least a year now, and no one has convincingly either killed it or shown it to be correct. It smells nice in various ways. You might ask, how can you make a string out of zero brains? And it's kind of in the obvious way. There's a certain sense in which the string becomes like a necklace. And that fits nicely with the idea that a string was kind of a big, clumsy thing, and you really wanted to think about it as being made out of bits. But the actual nature of what these bits are and how they join up into this necklace is more complicated than the picture really conveys. In particular, what you would think of as their coordinates, their positions, are actually matrices. So these have one version of what's called non-commutative geometry. And that's why it's more subtle than just saying it's non-relativistic point particles again. Okay. So to conclude, the problem was to understand the dynamics of string theory, and even more, to understand the definition of the theory to meet Wilson's criterion. We know a lot more about the dynamics of the theory, but we certainly don't know all of its dynamics. There's a lot of things we still don't understand. And also, we certainly haven't met Wilson's criterion. But it's clear that in order to know what the theory is, we had to understand the things we've understood. In particular, among many others, the fact that the theory actually had a lot more symmetry than we thought it did is something which we had to learn. Of course, we are, just to emphasize this, we are studying the theory in its most symmetric state, its most symmetric vacua, because that's where the physics is simplest and most easily understood. And we're still at least one step away from coming back to the rather asymmetric vacuum in which we live. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Well, the answer to that's a function of time. I've just spent 10 years writing a book explaining that the answer to that question is, I mean, this is just, you know, again, other people's work, it's a pedagogical summary. The answer is you're summing up amplitudes. You're doing two-dimensional quantum field theory. You're integrating over two-dimensional quantum fields. Those two dimensions are the world sheet of the string in space-time. And various expectation values, just ordinary two-dimensional path integral expectation values in that two-dimensional quantum field theory are what are telling you the scattering amplitudes in space-time. The fact that the string world sheet is two-dimensional is the reason why, you know, I have things to talk to Matthew about, because the edge of the quantum Hall system is two-dimensional, one space, one time. However, this is really... This is nice, but this really just generates the perturbation theory for you. And now that we're in the post-perturbative age, nobody needs to read my book. In fact, in this theory, which again may be completely wrong, it may be wrong. You have a real Hamiltonian. You've got degrees of freedom, which are in the end large n by n matrices. And again, those matrices are just the positions of these objects. And you're just calculating transition amplitudes in quantum mechanics. So that's what you're calculating. No, every once in a while someone says something about why this might be the reason space-time is four-dimensional, and none of them ring true. There is no reason. I mean, you can various things are special about four dimensions. It's the critical dimension for gauge theory. It's the dimension for gauge theory is interesting dynamics, but is that the reason? But nothing stands out as that. You know, the string theory probably has. It's hard, even when all of dynamics is understood, it seems almost certain that string theory will have more than one stable vacuum. It will undoubtedly have a very supersymmetric 11-dimensional vacuum. It will also have some number of four-dimensional vacua with different kinds of physics. And it may be that the reason we live in one rather than the other is just cosmology, an accident of, you know, history. hopefully, even if that's true, there'll be a small enough number of vacuum that only one of them will be anything like the one we live in, and we can, so we don't have to understand why we're in that one.
Theory on this
week? No, F-theory is somewhere over here. I've never been able to fit this F-theory in that picture, which tells you sort of what I think of the subject. F-theory is two different things. One is, it's a clever way to describe some set of vacua of one of these string theories, the 2B string theory. In particular, it's a clever way to describe some set of vacua in which the coupling is large in some places and small in others. So it's very hard to describe in any perturbative way. This parameterization requires that you add two extra dimensions on to the 10 that you start with. And there were conjectures, more ambitious conjectures, that these two dimensions were real in the same sense that the 11th M theory dimension is real. And I think that doesn't seem, well, those are the conjectures. It's clear that even if this is correct in some form, it's much more artificial than in the case of M theory. This is a real dimension. You go to this vacuum and you really look and you have 10 different directions you can look in. You know, it's just like any other dimension. These are artificial and have special properties. F theory kind of. A lot of the things you just named were dimensional, but not all of them. Let me take the simplest dimensionless. Well, any dimensionless constant you can make, like the gauge couplings, will in some sense be in the end related to the shape of the compact space, the compactified dimensions, some dimensionless. So it's not a parameter in the Hamiltonian. It's a parameter determined by the ground state. You would need to understand the dynamics that determines that shape, and that determines